My name is Bruce Silverman. This morning, I'm going to tell you about the very beginnings of KBOO, the years before the station went on the air. It's good to look back once in a while. The KBOO story is an example of a group of people coming together to accomplish a goal, to solve a problem. And you may be amazed at the determination of some of the people involved. And, as you'll hear, today is a very important anniversary in KBOO's history. I should make it clear that I was not here back then, but I have been made the keeper of KBOO's paper trail, so to speak, and I've tried to familiarize myself with the story. First, just a few words on the beginnings of radio, and then the beginnings of community radio. The technology, the concept of transmitting waves of sound through the atmosphere, was discovered in the 1880s. Radio stations in the United States flourished in the early 1920s. For example, what is now Oregon Public Broadcasting went on the air in 1922 as a project of the Physics Department of Oregon State College, now Oregon State University. In 1949, a man named Lou Hill started a radio station in San Francisco. He wasn't in it for the money. Station KPFA had an unprecedented mission. This World War II conscientious objector and his friends wanted to foster understanding amongst nations and individuals, to encourage creativity, and to promote innovative, uncensored distribution of news. Along with unprecedented content and views, note that this was the first listener-sponsored station in America. One person who had worked at KPFA was a man named Lorenzo Milam. In 1962, he managed to start a station in KPFA's image in Seattle. The Seattle station was called KRAB, Crab. Meanwhile, in Portland in the early 60s, there was a classical music station, actually a for-profit station, KGMG. It may be hard to believe, but back then, classical was considered alternative. KGMG's owner, Rogan Jones of Seattle, saw that he wasn't making money, wasn't selling enough commercials, and he changed the station's format. A Portland woman named Lloyd Livingston was not happy about this. First, she offered to sell advertising for KGMG without salary. That offer was politely turned down. Then she wrote a letter to columnist Doug Baker at Portland's daily evening newspaper, the Oregon Journal. I'm going to read that letter to you. Lloyd was an unusual woman, to say the least. I'll tell you more about her in a few minutes, but just listen to her fascinating writing style. Dear Mr. Baker, bravo for your May 25th lamentation on the pursuit of excellence. Another case in point, KGMG FM, Portland Radio's last stronghold of integrity, which dropped heritage programming last month. The thousands of us whose lives were enmeshed with Mozart, enhanced with Haydn, enriched with Ravel, enlightened with Lalo, embellished with Bartok, entranced with Telemann, endowed with Dvorak, encompassed with Chopin, engrossed with Grieg, enveloped with Villa-Lobos, are now mortified with Mantovani and Marty Gold. Perhaps local businessmen acknowledge the classical audience as a nucleus of Madison Avenue iconoclasts as they direct their advertising dollars towards stations satisfying the 8 to 12-year-old intellect. It is a tragic loss for this community to be deprived of a full-time serious music station. I, for one, am willing to subscribe to the support of such a station. Are there others eager to engage against air pollution? The letter is signed Lloyd H. Livingstone, 2849 Northwest Ariel Terrace, Portland. That letter, with its call for allies, is, to me, the beginning of KBOO, and it was published on Memorial Day, May 30th, 1964, 50 years ago today. Happy birthday to us. People did respond to Lloyd Livingstone's letter. Meetings were held at her house at first, and at lightning speed, a nonprofit organization was incorporated by July 17, 1964. It was named Listener Supported Radio. I'm going to give you names of a few people who attended those meetings. Most of these people are gone now, but if you know or knew any of them, you should know that they got this station going. Carl Bachhuber, professor in the physics department at Portland State College. Alfred Bork, professor of physics at Reed College. Maria DeRungs, professor in the music departments of Merrillhurst and Lewis and Clark College. Jack Dudman, dean of students at Reed College. Bernard Fetty, attorney and professor at Portland State College. Ernie Hood, musician, composer, DJ. Sol Peck, executive director of the Robeson Jewish Home for the Aged. Charles Sachs, architect. Amos Stenovic, who is listed as a housewife. And Don Wilner, former state legislator. The group pursued several options. By September, they learned that Reed College, which had its own tiny radio station, it could only be heard on campus, was considering growing that into a real FM frequency within a few months. The word was that Reed would broadcast from 4 p.m. to midnight and might be willing to lease the frequency for the remaining 17 hours a day for $500 per month. The minutes from their meetings indicate that this seemed like a lot of money to our group, and they hoped that they could simply find their way to supporting the Reed station, although they were concerned that it wouldn't be music all the time. If they did decide to support the Reed station, they talked about continuing their organization as a nonprofit support group, sort of like Friends of the Library. They were thinking about memberships at $15 a year and didn't expect more than a few hundred subscribers. With that, they would print and distribute a listener guide. They also heard from the owner of another station that had been playing some classical, who predicted that their supporters would be few and not loyal. Meanwhile, the owner of KGMG, the last classical station which had just dropped that music, offered to rent his station for $1,500 a month. Again, the group didn't think they could raise the money. Another thing that man did was to tell Lloyd and her cohorts about Lorenzo Milam and his strange and strangely funded nonprofit station in Seattle. And he got the two connected. Here's how Lorenzo described it in a 1998 email to KBOO. After we put Crab in Seattle on the air, the fourth listener-supported station in the country, I got a call from one Lloyd E. Livingstone, who lived in Portland. The last classical music station had just been sold and changed its format, and she wanted us to start a Crab-like station for the community. I said, sure, and hung up, and forgot all about it. We were, after all, involved with problems of our own. Well, she had persistence, if nothing else. She must have called me 20 times. She was always very nice, but she was always very insistent. Portland was going to have a good radio station, and we were going to do it. Finally, just to shut her the hell up, Jeremy Lanceman, a colleague at Crab, and I drove down, and after meeting with her, found ourselves promising to put in an application with the FCC if she found a transmitter and a transmitter site. That'll keep her out of our hair, I told Jeremy. She called me the next week. She had the transmitter and the site, and when could I put in the application? She had me. This was late in 1964. In January 65, Lloyd reported to her group that Crabb was planning to install a strong translator in Chehalis, Washington, so that that station could be heard all the way south to Eugene. At that point, the Crabb proposal became their favorite. There was a hope and possibility that there could be some local volunteering and program content eventually. Lorenzo took part in a public forum in Portland in June 1965. He was impressed by the support he saw for Crabb's programming to be broadcast here. While in town, he met with the president of Reed College and was told that they didn't want to lease out any part of their airtime because the college would not have adequate control over what went on the air. Lorenzo also felt that the Portlanders could never raise enough money to start their own station. He estimated that at $20,000. He suggested to the Portland group that they continue as a nonprofit, but under the wing of Crabb's nonprofit structure known as the Jack Straw Memorial Foundation. And he pledged that eventually Portland would work out of its own studio and go independent. In fact, that's sort of what happened. The Chehalis translator was skipped in favor of one right in Portland. It took 3 years for the FCC to approve the application. A main reason for the delay was that no station in the so-called educational band of the FM range had ever applied for a second frequency. On the technical side, Lorenzo had a contact who lived on Healy Heights above Oregon Health and Science University, who was willing to have the transmitter installed on a pole in his backyard. Someone else was found who would host the special receiver to pick up Crabb from 170 miles away in Seattle. An engineer, Dave Calhoun, was sent from Seattle to set all this up. He lived on the porch of Michael Wells' house. You may recognize Michael's name. He later became station manager and has served on KBOO's board 3 times, including right now. While waiting for FCC approval, Calhoun found a small space for a studio so that right from the beginning, KBOO could broadcast both Crabb content and content originated in Portland. Part of the FCC application process was that an applicant had to suggest call letters for their station. Considering the history of Lorenzo's stations having cutesy names like KDNA, KTAO, Kadao, and KRAB, you won't be surprised at what they came up with. Here's one of our founders, Ern Hood, reading the list later on the air.
Hi, this is Ern Hood with another historical vignette from KBOO's Dusty Attic of Crummy Memories, Chapter 3. You'll remember last time I had offered my list of call letters to Lorenzo Milam, our beginner in Seattle, and a copy of his letter to the FCC arrived at my mailbox and reads as follows. The heading on the stationery, KRAB, Seattle, 27th of June, 1967. Dear Ben F. Wapple, or Waple, Secretary, FCC, Washington, D.C. Dear Mr. Waple, this is in reference to the recent grant of construction permit to the Jack Straw Memorial Foundation for a new non-commercial FM station in Portland, Oregon, BPED-707. We would like to submit the following call letters for the new station's identification. Number 1, KBOO. 2, KZEN. 3, KAZU. 4, KAMA. 5, KVAS. Umlaut on the A, of course. 6, KOTO. 7, KOAN. 8, KIEF. 9, KRAC. 10, KLSR, listener-supported radio, to give the Straits a chance, he says. And 11, KRUD. Thank you sincerely, Lorenzo W. Milam, President, the Jack Straw Memorial Foundation. Ernie, please show this list to Amo. Now, Amo was a cellist who played at Merrillhurst and other places, and she was actively involved, another personage from the early days. I loved your picture. You are very scenic, as is your sign. It was an advertisement for marijuana cigarettes from Vera Cruz. Please ask Amo or someone to get a mailbox in Portland as soon as we have received call letter permission from the FCC. There will be more historical stuff later in our next chapter from The KBOO Attic of Dusty Memories. Theme music, The Lancashire Rag, written and played by Bill Hood.
The winning suggestion came from Nancy Keith of Crab. And let's make this very clear, because there has been some confusion over the years. The choice may have been made on Halloween because the FCC station application was sent in soon afterwards. But Boo wasn't chosen just because it was Halloween. It refers to Berkeley Boo, the variety of pot being smoked on the West Coast at that time. If the staid FCC staff had known that, they wouldn't have approved it any more than they would have approved KRUD. But they probably didn't get the reference, especially because there in Washington, people smoked Panama Red, not Berkeley Boo. Let's listen for a few minutes to a conversation among four people who were involved during that pre-broadcast period, 1965 through 1968. You'll hear Dave Calhoun, radio engineer who was sent down from Crab to help set up KBOO. Also, Gray Hartig, a Portland area radio engineer still working in the industry. Michael Wells, whose porch Dave Calhoun slept on. And Jim Olding, who hosted a jazz program here for many years. This conversation took place in 1998. On our 30th anniversary on the air, and it's a little bit hard to listen to because in the background you'll hear some drumming. This round table took place outside in front of the KBOO studios. We had three stages of performance going on too.
Where had I been? I've been wandering around the Kentucky in the upper Midwest helping an old uncle die. I came back to Seattle. I've been around Crab off and on for years. And I walked in and, well, I need something to do. And Lorenzo said, you're it. You're going to Portland. So with 2 days' warning, I got thrown in the truck. Jeremy Landsman, who was one of the engineering brains of it all, was on his way to St. Louis with all the engineering equipment for the radio station that he and Lorenzo, the legendary grandfather, were going to build there, KDNA. He had a year and a half old boy with him.
Jason.
I never quite figured out whose son Jason actually was. They have something to do with
Cammy. Yes, Cammy.
got. Anyway, there was a truckload of radio station stuff, and Jeremy was driving straight through to St. Louis. He had two clean diapers and a supply of acid to keep himself awake.
And a U-Haul truck.
Yeah, a U-Haul truck. And I was just dropped off in Portland on the way. The equipment I had for this was my Blaupunkt car radio for a monitor and a couple of screwdrivers and a list of names of people who might possibly help. And there it was.
Who stoked the fire under that transmitter anyway?
Howard Singleton.
Harold Singleton was a senior broadcast engineer in Portland. He's the one who originally tied the antenna lead onto the antenna at KBPS with a piece of string. Had a whole basement full of old oil cans he might want to use for balance someday.
But he was going to reinforce the concrete slabs in his basement with oil cans.
He had a house utterly atop Healy Heights, and behind his house was a little 20-foot antenna tower. And onto that antenna tower, somehow Lorenzo and crew had managed to tack a homemade imitation antenna.
And was it made out of a coat hanger, perhaps?
No, it was actually quite well made. Jeremy had a local machine shop put it together as a knockoff of a commercial antenna.
And in the garage was our transmitter, which was historically serial number 3 of a General Electric 1948 tube-type transmitter. This was historically nice because the transmitter of Crab in Seattle was serial number 3 of an old Collins.
That's right.
This transmitter used a device which is worth a chapter in itself, the phasotron modulating tube. But this stuff was stacked up in Harold's garage behind the packing crate in which he'd shipped a bunch of antiques back from Spain, and on the other side of a paging transmitter whose signal kept getting into our audio line, so we'd turn on the transmitter and we'd get someone saying, "There are no messages at present."
How far did that 10 watts carry in those days?
10 watts will carry a long ways. If you think about a 10 watt light bulb, you can see it a long ways away.
Especially if it's sitting on top of Healy Heights.
Well, if there's not a lot of glare in the sky. Around Healy Heights and close in Portland, there's a tremendous amount of RF noise then as now. And
much worse now.
Most of the FM radios people had in those days were still tube radios in which FM had been tacked in as sort of an incidental. So getting the signal was really iffy. On the other hand, I was talking outside about somebody who picked up the 10-watt signal on a radio in the Mount Jefferson Wilderness area.
And we had a subscriber out in Washougal ran the auto show.
But, of course, this nice person called in from to tell me he'd picked up our signal very triumphantly in Mount Jefferson Wilderness area, and my first response was, "What the hell were you doing with a radio in the wilderness area?" I have to say, though, before we lose the possibility, the first night in Portland, I spent the night on the floor of an old friend of this place, Ernie Hood.
Right on.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise known as Ernesto Hoodwink or Hog Thistlefield. who was the real mainstay of support in those early months. Even though he couldn't do much physically, he'd had polio and was in a wheelchair. He was the one who had the patience to drag me through the months and months and months of trying to get our permit to actually broadcast something. The equipment was in place for months. It was 9 months that I was here. It had been there some time before that, before we finally got the telegram, which gave us permission to actually
flip the switch
to send something other than beeps and honks.
That was radio engineer Dave Calhoun talking about setting up KBOO's transmitter and equipment, along with radio engineer Gray Hartig, Michael Wells, and moderator KBOO DJ Jim Olding. Now we'll continue with the story of those pre-broadcast years. We're going to hear again from Ern Hood.
We eventually found a downtown location for the station in the rat-infested basement of a building on Sleazo Corner, 234 Southwest Salmon. I remember Calhoun borrowed a remote amplifier from Singleton's garage up on Healy Heights so that I could broadcast from my home. He'd call me up at 3 a.m. in the morning and ask me if I felt like filling in for a few hours. Well, the remote unit had four inputs through which I would feed two tape recorders, a turntable, and a microphone, often sometimes simultaneously. Well, when I'd do that, Calhoun would reciprocate down at the basement downtown. This whole mishmash was mixed on another recorder and sent to Pakistan, with which we had a cultural exchange of audio material. I often wonder what the people of Pakistan must think of the mentality of the poor people of Portland or the sea. Well, those were carefree days when I could play 4.5 hours of 1920s music and have people call in to plead, "Don't stop." The feeds from KRAB would contain 24 hours of pure raga, without interruption, without station breaks or anything. Lots of four-letter words would fly across the ether, too. The FCC guys would come down and threaten, but we would threaten back with tales of social redemption, and they'd back off.
KBOO received its final approval from the FCC and began broadcasting in June 1968. Ern Hood is gone now, but his son, Tom Hood, is currently KBOO's chief engineer. Gray Hartig is still a radio engineer, and he lives in the house formerly owned by Harold Singleton on Healy Heights, right next door to KBOO's transmitter and antenna. Lorenzo Milam is no longer involved with radio. He's on the internet. You can look him up on Wikipedia, where you'll find books that he has written. And he's involved with a website, ralph.com. He's still quite the Renaissance man. Lloyd Livingston passed away a couple of years ago. I only met her on the telephone shortly before she died, but I learned more afterwards. She was quite a woman. She arrived in Portland at the beginning of 11th grade and went to the old Lincoln High School, what's now Lincoln Hall of Portland State University. By 12th grade, she was so popular, so well-loved, that her fellow students chose her as the Rose Festival Princess for Lincoln High, and she became the Queen of the Rose Festival, 1947. She left Portland in 1965. Her marriage broke up, and she moved to Southern California. Never heard KBOO until I put her on hold at the station once, early in the 2000s, and she heard the Grateful Dead show, and she was very happy to hear it. The last thing she said to me as we ended our conversation was, "Have fun." For KBOO, this is Bruce Silverman.
This is KBOO Portland. Time is 11:30. Coming up on the Incomparable Radio Zine, Megan Murphy, founder and editor of the website Feminist Current, talks about the killings committed by Elliot Rodger and the misogynist cultural messages we see today. Thank you, KBU members, for your generous support. If you missed our recent spring membership drive, you can fix that with a visit to kboo.fm. You click where it says donate today. Keep it locked right here. 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland, your community radio.